You know that anxious feeling of butterflies in your stomach, where you're overflowing with excitement and nerves and worry because you've just made a huge decision that's about to change the rest of your life? Hello, I'm Kirsty Melville, and that's what we're exploring today on 360 Documentaries here on RN, that moment when you take a leap of faith and change your life.
I escaped an abusive relationship by moving across the country. I had to escape, do or die. I looked for somewhere else to live. Sydney had been calling for a while, from across the continent. Could I get a job in Sydney? I applied for one. I was interviewed. I got the job. When did they want me? Next week? Oh, right. Book a hotel, give away furniture, give away cookware, give away books, give away clothes, see family, see friends, two suitcases, a plane ticket. I was ready. My new beginning. I came to Sydney and came back to myself.
A new beginning can be sparked by trauma, by joy, by love, by a tough decision, by birth of a new life or a new idea. It can take immense courage to create a new beginning, and it can take immense courage to deal with one thrust upon you. Last year, ABC Pool and 360 Documentaries called out for your stories around the theme New Beginnings. We wanted you to get creative and share your perspective, ideas and experiences. The stories you're going to hear today are just some of the contributions we received from that call out. People uploaded their photos, videos, audio and text to ABC Pool, and Mike Williams glued it all together to make today's feature. So join us as we wade through stories and experiences, most of them spoken to you by the people who wrote them. Today, it's all about new beginnings.
Every morning is a new beginning. It is a chance to start anew, washed clean by sleep and rest, and inspired by the empty hours of the night, transported by the morning light, be it a gold streak or a shy shade on the horizon. Every morning is the chance to do whatever we've been doing a little better, a little bit different. It doesn't take much to start anew. It doesn't take much to start anew.
On my way home, I was thinking about the accident. I'd been thinking about it for a while now. The kid that ran into me. The kid who changed my life so dramatically. I just couldn't remember his name. I used to know it off by heart. Not something you forget easily. I remember him sitting on the side of the road, his work ute written off, and his face in his hands, weeping in self-pity. And I struggled, immobilised, broken, bleeding out, and straining for breath against the choking strap of my helmet. My wife picked me up from hospital to attend the coroner's inquest. I remember his face. His family were there supporting him as the judge made his ruling. He was up for culpable driving, reckless endangerment, maiming me, and killing my PM. I remember clearly the pivotal moment where I put my hand on the silver door handle, the feel of the cold metal, my wife manoeuvring my wheelchair so that we could enter. I remember my thoughts and the conundrum that faced me at that moment. If he got a harsh punishment, I would have felt vengeful, a vicious satisfaction that within me would have been bad karma. If he got a light sentence, I would have felt ripped off. I'd want him punished properly. Either option would have been bad karma within me. I just couldn't win. So I took my hand from the shiny metal handle on the glass door and turned to my wife and said, "Take me back." I went back to the hospital not knowing, not wanting to know, simply for my own spiritual well-being. I didn't want to know. To this day, I still don't know, and I still don't want to. But you know now, I can't even remember his name. And I think that's a sign of the healing. And I think that's a good thing.
I wish I had thrown the cloudberry at them, yep. It was an incredibly special day. And they just seemed so sour. They're in Helsinki. There's people skiing down the street in front of them. They're eating at old Soviet tractors. It was amazing, and they didn't appreciate it, so I should have thrown the damn cloudberry. I really should have. I regret that.
Every year on Mother's Day, I like to stop and reflect. I'm not here to say Mother's Day, bah humbug, but I think it does us good to pause a while, cut through the sentimentality and commercialism, and take a realistic look at mothers. Like my four, all of them mine. To become a mother is not so difficult, but being a mother can be very difficult. For some, motherhood is an accident and not always a welcome one. For some, biological motherhood isn't possible. For some, motherhood is all too brief, resulting in sadness and loss. For some, motherhood under the very best of circumstances is still less than a bed of roses or a primrose path. I had four mothers. How, you're probably wondering. Let me tell you four stories. Laurel Rose Irene King of Broken Hill married Harry Lamb, also of Broken Hill, who was a baker and part-time professional bike rider. They had all the dreams of any newlyweds, and in 1939 they were expecting their first child. For some, motherhood can be tragic, and this was one of those occasions. Laurel gave birth to twins, but they did not survive the complicated birth. Laurel also contracted a kidney infection that nearly claimed her life straight after the stillbirth of her twins. The damage to her health caused by that infection did eventually claim her life some 20 years later, at the age of 43. She became my first mother in 1941 when they adopted a three-month-old boy from the Kate Cox home at Brighton in South Australia.
I'd never had to choose between two tractors before. The one by the window was mustard yellow. The stools scattered around it provided a stellar view of downtown Helsinki. But the one by the bar was cherry red with flames dancing down the sides. It had my name written all over it. I only knew two Finnish words. Kiitos means thank you. The other was pretty much the most offensive word in the language. It was my first day in Finland and I was so jet-lagged, I was afraid I'd get the two mixed up and accidentally call a barista a particular part of the female anatomy. Here I was in a rockabilly bar run by iconic band the Leningrad Cowboys, surrounded by chicken wire and Soviet hot rod tractors as tables. My smile was wide. I was even wearing gingham for the occasion, as every good cowgirl should. I'd found that the first step on the soil of a new land tends to set the tone for the whole journey. Fresh off the plane from Melbourne and about to wend my way through northeastern Europe to who knew where, I was in search of new words on my tongue and medieval stones under my boots. The signs so far were damn good. I took a seat at the red tractor. There was a ledge built around it to dine on. The menu was in Finnish and English, and I scanned it for something exotic and suitably Scandinavian. And Lord, did I find it. When the waitress came to take my order, all mermaid tattoos and crooked teeth, I didn't even hesitate. I'll have the smoked reindeer, thanks. The day was getting better and better. I drank Finnish beer as I waited and wrote it all down in my little red notebook. When I tell people that I looked out the window and saw a rather jaunty Finn in denim hot pants literally skiing down the street with poles digging into the cracks of the footpath, My friends raise their eyebrows and fondly accuse my imagination of going one step too far. I know what I saw, okay? The reindeer came with blinis, thick golden pancakes smeared with sour cream and wild mushrooms. I ate every single skerrick, licking the last of the reindeer from my fingertips. My holiday mantra was no diet, no budget, no shame. I reached for the dessert menu, and when I saw cloudberries with caramel sauce, I caught the attention of the waitress.
Oh yeah, cloudberries. They grow in the north of Finland. Swamps?
Really?
Yeah, you pick them one by one. It's not easy work. Very special Finnish treat you would like.
I would indeed. I sat with my phrase book while I waited and barely read a line. I was having too much fun eavesdropping and trying to identify the languages. A sour American couple sat nearby, staring over the tops of their menus and snapping at each other in tense tones. I wasn't going to let their mood affect my first night on the road. I imagined taking a cloudberry, hand-picked from a Finnish swamp, and throwing it their way. I imagined watching it ping against her glasses. Hey, don't you know this is a cloudberry day? And when my dessert came, plump little spheres and a rich golden sauce, I pushed four of them onto the prongs with my fork and slid them into my mouth. All at the same time.
Man, I was floating hard. A burning arrow. Direction? Combustible. Will you kneel to save me? Will you go in over your head? Will you honour my scars, her confusion? Will you orientate yourself in the wasteland of my youth, where the well-worn tracks are on these arms? Where the beautiful is sold to fund the funfair? Will you forgive what she did to Grandma? I thought I'd get more. Will you credit the stars in her eyes? Will you give me a new beginning? Will you pick up the mess in my children's lives? Will you believe his truth on top of so many lies? Will you acknowledge that line that says, this is past? Will you shake the hand that shakes alone? Will you flip another card, open another door? Can you see my new beginning? Can you let go, let be, give him his new beginning? Can you see my new beginning?
Give him his new beginning. Give him his new beginning.
After Laurel's death in 1960, her husband, Harry, began to descend into an alcoholic haze. One of his favourite pubs was the Silverton Hotel of Mad Max fame. The Silverton was owned by George Kane, who introduced Harry to his widowed mother, Edna. They married and lived at Broken Hill. Edna became my second mother, whom we would visit frequently. Edna had had a tough life before meeting Harry. She lived in a remote outback camp with the dog fence maintenance gang, of whom her first husband was a member. Although she had several children, motherhood was a sad experience for her as she watched her four-year-old daughter, Daphne, die of diphtheria beyond any medical assistance in the far outback. After her marriage to Harry, she broke the strict code of adoption confidentiality, believing I should know that I was adopted. Harry vehemently denied the story, and since he was my father, I believed him rather than this new mother he had married.
Friday the 13th, wouldn't you know it? I was scheduled for another op. Nothing major. Just rebuilding an elbow. Compared to the last 3 months, it was a walk in the park. I was apprehensive, though, more worried than usual. More worried than made sense.
But Scuzzy found a peace comforting her and a growing awareness that turned to Shorty.
I can't explain how I knew, but it altered how I was responding to everyone around me.
And each person she made peace with helped quell her fear for what was to come.
When the hospital staff came with a trolley, I was calm within myself. I transferred clumsily with my one leg onto the cold white sheet and I relaxed. I let the drugs that they gave me take over.
Omnipon and scopolamine,
still my all-time favourite pre-meds. Time floated past. Busy nurses, heaps of sound carried on around me. I smiled as I was pushed through to the theatre. I looked at the world for the last time. The green mask.
One, count to ten. 3, 4, 5.
I can never remember making it past 6.
What happened then is recounted in the medical charts, but not the bits that she remembers.
It redefined my thoughts on religion, faith, myself, as part of the universe.
Scuzzy.
I died.
I died.
On the operating table. I saw everything I'd done in my life laid out before me like coins on a table. And it reminded me of the old jar that we had. You know, the one that everybody has filled with coins. A flag, and we had a flag and filled with copper coins, and there were 5 and 10 cent pieces in it, you know, because no larger coins would fit inside.
The copper coins represented all the things she had done as a living creature to survive.
All the time thinking of work and shopping and eating and shitting and making money and chasing love and sex and all that stuff that you do.
But the much smaller group, the silver coins, that was the stuff she had done selflessly for others.
I wish it hadn't have been quite so small when I looked at it. They were the times when I'd swallowed my pride or just done something really impulsively out of love for someone else, you know, not even a person, maybe an animal. And as they separated and began flowing like in opposite directions, my consciousness flowed to the one that was the most important to me, and I became those things.
Scuzzy floated in black and could have sworn she was in the deepest parts of outer space.
I looked and looked and looked for stars, like it was a blackness. And my body, when I looked, glowed pale, as if composed entirely of like a translucent aqua crystal. And it was complete and whole. It was such a shock. Because I just got so used to creating and surviving with an image that matched the broken body I inhabited.
Scuzzy could feel something soaking into her, an emotion. She could sense the direction it was coming from in the same way you can gauge the direction of the sun as it hits your neck.
And this was seeping like much, much deeper than sunshine, where sunshine feels like it soaks in, you know, like a half an inch, a quarter of an inch, just a little bit on your skin. This soaked in, you know, 3/4 deep into my skin, really deep. And I turned the direction it was coming from. I couldn't not. And I saw an image like a full moon, but much larger and brighter. So bright that the white was blue around the edges. So white, like an arc welder's glow. And I focused.
But the further she looked, the further the core of the light sank, deeper and deeper. Scuzzy understood now why some people call it the tunnel.
But what radiated from the tunnel, from this being, wasn't light. It was an emotion I was being bathed in, and it was hard to describe. Such a blissful mixture of emotions to break them up and describe the combination of like a pure love and grace. Grace itself, to me, it was like an amplified version of being bathed in love and acceptance. And the only thing I can hold it to is when you're held in your mother's arms, and that's that purity.
And Scuzzy spoke to God and God to her.
He spoke directly into my head, and there was no doubt. I am the way, the truth and the light. To the eternal being, to the God of Moses and Abraham and to Christ himself, I responded, fuck, that's biblical. The light didn't falter. The emotion of love and acceptance didn't wane one iota. And he knew me. He understood and accepted me for who I am. And he didn't judge me for my failings.
Scuzzy.
I'd already done that.
Had already done that.
I learnt that God loves us for who we are unconditionally. And if he accepts us, then we need have little concern for any man who doesn't. Being dead isn't bad. It's the dying that kills you.
What are your emotions at the moment? Because it's a huge leap, isn't it, after 51 years in your house?
I'm very happy to go back to Barham where there's no traffic and plenty of space. Good weather, I hope. Very cold in the winter, very hot in the summer.
And that doesn't bother you?
No. Well, you can stay inside if it's hot and you can stay inside if it's cold. I'm going up to Barham in New South Wales, which is on the Murray River. That was where I was born and brought up, went to school, know all my girlfriends up there and aunts and uncles, cousins. So I'm going back to spend time with them.
What precious memories do you have of growing up in Barham?
Ask me that. Going out to the farm in the school holidays and taking girlfriends with me and having a good time out with Grandpa and Grandma and the aunts and the uncles. I can see you. So much better under
big blue western skies. I'm looking at a picture of the house that you've bought in Barham, and it's really interesting, and I feel as though it's got atmosphere and character. Could you just describe it a little bit?
It was built by a Spanish couple, and I used to live next door to it, and that's one of the reasons why I'm quite happy to move back to there, knowing the house. And I know the granddaughter that lived there. She left Melbourne. She's back in Barham, so I'll catch up with her. There's a small garden. Oh, yes, the stained glass windows and the fans in all the bedrooms. It's been modernised inside, so it should be very comfortable.
Do you have chooks in the backyard?
No, I don't have any chooks, and I don't want any cats, and I don't want any birds or dogs.
What about roosters? Will you be able to hear roosters?
No, because I'm in the centre of the town. I just have to walk across the road to the shops. And I have shops right beside me.
It actually looks like a very suburban house. Will it be suburban living?
No, I don't think so. Not in the country. Not for me anyway. I'll be glad to get away from the suburbs and the rat race of Rosanna Road.
So what's suburban living in your mind?
Oh, living close to people and children and dogs barking and all the rest of it.
So is it more people-oriented life, living in the suburbs, or do you think you'll get that more in the country?
I'll probably get that more in the country because my family are connected with different charities, so I'll be helping there with them. I have two op shops sort of right practically next door to me, so I can take my choice which one I go to.
So you'd recommend it?
I certainly do.
Okay, I'm going to ask an on-the-spot question.
No.
Yes. Since your husband died, you've been a single lady, a widow, for quite a few years. Have you got any love to look forward to in Barham?
Well, I'll have to wait and see when I get up there, won't I?
There's a twinkle in your eye.
And it's going to stay there. I can see.
Forced or by choice, life-changing or insignificant. It sounds corny, but it's true. Each day is a new beginning, a fresh chance, if that's the way you choose to see it. You're listening to 360 Documentaries with me, Kirsty Melville, here on RN, and to a program all about new beginnings, largely made by you, the listener. Last year, we asked for your stories about new beginnings you've experienced, and listeners from all around Australia and overseas responded with their stories, experiences and ideas on the topic. And we're listening to some of them now.
When Edna died in 1975, Harry moved to Adelaide to live with us. Never a good move. It was to our great relief that within a couple of years he announced his engagement to Degma Bennett, one of the widows in our church. Deg was a lady of very high principles. She even gave up her late husband's very lucrative Commonwealth superannuation to marry an old age pensioner, Harry, my father. By doing this, she became my third mother that I can recall on Mother's Day. Deg outlived Harry, who died in 1986. I am sure that it was her own strong belief in truth that inspired her to accidentally let slip in 1993 that I was adopted and not really Laurel and Harry's son. She had no other details, just that I was adopted. So after having three mothers to celebrate on Mother's Day, I was back to none. The code of confidentiality surrounding adoption existed until relatively recently. It was against the law to tell. If you accept that pregnancy out of marriage is shameful, then there were sound reasons for that secrecy. Motherhood is a joyful event and is thought of as something to celebrate. Discovering that you're adopted is scary. So what do you do about it? Do you try to find out who your birth parents are and try to contact them? What if your birth mother has kept the secret all her life and not even her husband knows of her shame? Would making public the events of so long ago place enormous strain on or even destroy her family? To find out that you are adopted is also to find out that you are not wanted. What if you find your birth parents and they don't want to meet you? Could you cope with being rejected again?
Sydney here. Listen, I've heard you've been having a hard time and I was really sad to hear that, but I think you should come down here, you know? I can take you out. I can show you some places. I can cheer you up a little bit. This could be a whole new start for you. Please, come and stay with me for a while, all right? Just think it over and I think we could have a really good time, okay? So call me back. See you soon. Ciao.
Do pay attention. Old loves never quite die. New ones are never quite so new. One day you find a new interest and dive in for more information, knowledge and skills. You work hard even, gain know-how. Then with time it seems to get dimmer and dimmer, and you'd think you'd all but forgotten it. But you have not. You certainly have not. It's just going through a latent phase, a dormant phase. Old loves never die. Old loves just live on in the dark side of your life. They're the ones you don't feel and don't look at. And then one day, one night, it's back. You don't grow in a rigid line. You grow in phases and circles. Only you, know how new this old love is. It may have been there all along, long before you're even aware of it, and long after you think it was gone. It feeds on you just like you feed on it, making you rich with potential development and rich with experience gained.
I escaped an abusive relationship by moving across the country. A friend tried to console me, saying, "God only sends angels." To which I quipped, "Yeah, I know this one's name, Lucifer."
Old loves never quite die.
The relationship was abusive. Not physically, I would have spotted that sooner. Emotional abuse is insidious. It seeps, infects, destroys. We're unconscious of all the things that go into making up who we are until they're taken away. Mind.
Don't be stupid. They talk crap. Turn it off.
Speech.
I can't believe you said that. Don't say things like that.
Style.
You're going to wear that?
Laughter.
That's not funny. Switch channels.
Body.
Grow your hair longer. Go to the gym more.
Spirituality. He believed in the power of now, so was not interested in knowing my past. He shut the door on who I was, so I lost sight of it. Eventually, I didn't know who I was, what I wanted, or where I was going. Strangely, he berated me for having no ambition. Apparently now includes the future. But everybody loved him. His friends all looked up to him. He was the life of the party. He was the apple of his family's eyes. But nobody saw. Nobody knew. I reasoned, it must be me. It's me. Of course it's me. How could everybody else be so wrong? How was it that I was so detestable that I could never please such a great guy? So I changed. Moment to moment, trying to read his moods before he had them. Trying to please. Trying to be better. Trying to be. I fell pregnant. He said he didn't want children. I couldn't end its life. The house grew tenser. Tenser. At 3 months, I miscarried. After agonising in bed for hours, my hopes for that child fell away in the shower. Hospital. Scraping. They gave me a toy in remembrance. He called me selfish. I had to escape, do or die. I looked for somewhere else to live. Why stay here? Sydney had been calling for a while, from across the continent. Could I get a job in Sydney? I applied for one. I was interviewed. I got the job. When did they want me? Next week? Oh, right. Book a hotel. Give away furniture. Give away cookware. Give away books. Give away clothes. See family. See friends. 2 suitcases. A plane ticket. I was ready. Sydney was overjoyed to see me.
Great to see you. You're looking good.
The harbour bridge exploded with colour and light above me as my taxi headed for the North Shore. The Mardi Gras fireworks heralded my arrival. My new beginning. I came to Sydney and came back to myself. On this foundation, the construction of a life began. My job is fulfilling yet challenging and is blossoming into a career. I've finished my master's and I've begun study towards a PhD. I have wonderful housemates and have gathered a group of funny, intelligent, caring and supportive friends around me. Sydney is home. He cried the morning I left. I have come to know Lucifer. He is the bringer of light. I am enlightened.
Here it comes now, round yonder bend. Here comes the music tomorrow will send. If a song is a road, well, it's one that won't end till it finds its way home to the heart of a friend. Remember me laughing, remember my song, remember remember the good times all night long. In the house by the river, in the house by the sea, when the voice of the land was singing to me. 10,000 days from Dublin to paradise, 10,000 days my heart like a drum beats out the rhythm to count the time passing, beats out the rhythm of time.
How it all happens. You get in touch with someone over the internet, talk on the phone, and after a week or two, it's obvious you must meet soon to check whether or not this kind of bond that is slowly coming together is real. So you book a flight from Europe, thinking all the while, this is crazy. Time goes by and eventually you get to the airport and fly halfway across the world to meet. Suddenly you're there. The person is there. You're taken for a 6-hour drive up north after flying something like 20 hours. Night is falling when you get to the farm in the bush. Unreal. This is when it all starts. Exhilarating. Breathtaking. You are where you should be. Your life takes on a new meaning. How does it feel at home in a strange environment where you must learn everything all over again? 3 weeks later, you must go to that other home back in Europe. A part of you will stay though. A part of you has already made its choice. This person, this place, this life. A complete makeover that will not be easy and certainly will take time. It will involve loss as well as bright new beginnings. A lot of learning and effort and faith. It will demand the best in you, and you know you will give it.
So I'm coming across the land and sea, through desert and through snow. I'll rest with you, but I am sure you'll never let it go. Knock down your door and ask once more, please give it back to me. I'll beg and plead and haggle and scream and cry till I can see. So if you can't, I've got a plan that surely would suffice. Give me a heart, give me a hand, and I'll make you my wife.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
In a few weeks, I'll be 64. The Beatles song comes to mind. Now, 2 years ago, at 62, I wept the whole way through the Bollywood movie My Name is Khan. The protagonist suffers from Asperger's syndrome, so he's an Aspie. Soon after I saw the film, a professional finally diagnosed me as being on the autism spectrum, which includes Asperger's. She confirmed her suspicions with information from older cousins and an aunt who could reliably describe me between the ages of 1 and 6. I lacked friends, was socially awkward, and was obsessed with numbers, lists, and patterns. There are a lot of reasons you can feel sorry for my failed life. I'll list some, but please don't feel sad. Laugh with me. I've had 100+ jobs. On average, they've lasted about 5 weeks. Only 3 of them lasted for more than a year. My shortest gig was 5 hours at the University of London Computing Centre. I've had 4 children with 2 different mothers, and my youngest is 12. He and his sister say they don't want to see me until they're 18. At school, I was labelled gifted. The group that I grew up in believed that my brains would pave the way to greatness. It didn't. I had no real friends because I can't get on with people. Since 14, I've seen counsellors, psychologists and psychiatrists. Their verdicts?
Totally normal, my boy. Come and do music therapy with the schizophrenics in my hospital.
Oh, you're such a bad sociopath who should keep away as far as possible from other people. I can't ever see you again.
The craziest? One man offered me therapeutic gay porn and then told me to come to his home and give his son piano lessons.
Yeah, it sounds amusing, but it's been hell. But here's the good bit. My hope. My joy at seeing 2012 arrive. I'm enrolled in a Master of Arts in Creative and Cultural Practice. The degree involves writing, theatre, music and sound. Everything that I care about.
Give me your answer. Fill in a form. Mine forevermore. Will you still need me?
In 2012, I will have another shot at being a student at the age of 64. Maybe this time I'll pay attention. I feel in some ways as if I may have come, during the last month or so, into a sort of paradise where my head may have stopped bleating at last and where there are flowers not torn out by constant mental storms. I hope I'm right.
Rather reluctantly, I eventually applied for an original pre-adoption birth certificate. No, I was not the long-lost son of royalty or the missing heir to some great multinational corporation. I was really not that keen on the Packers or Murdochs, and I always thought the Windsors were a dysfunctional family anyway. I was actually Richard Walter, not Ross Lamb, born in Rose Park, Adelaide, to Effie Erica Walter on the 5th of June 1941. A quick check of the Senate electoral roll revealed there was no such person enrolled in 1995 when I made the inquiry. She wasn't in any of the rolls readily available, which went back to the 1960s either. So, a dead end. The next step, after my usual period of procrastination, was to apply for a copy of Effie Erica Walter's marriage certificate. One of the big consequences of confidentiality, along with many others, is the lack of any family medical history. So after a bit of a melanoma scare in 1999, I succumbed to family encouragement and with a lot of support from my wife, Marie, wrote to all the Walters from the Riverland to the southeast of South Australia. Next day, I had a phone call from a guy saying, "I'm Peter Walter. I live at Lamoureux and I'm your mother's younger brother. I didn't know about you because I was only 12 at the time and they never told me anything. But my sister Margaret knows all about Richard Walter." This phone call was a real new beginning. I will forever be grateful to Peter and his wife June and their family for their acceptance and love, and to Peter for being the first person, other than my own daughters, to whom I bear any family resemblance. The Lambs and the Kings were all very short people, none of them 6'4" like me. What do I know about this fourth mother, although she is really my first and real mother? In 1940, she was a nurse engaged to a farmer of Pinneroo. As a member of the British Empire, Australia was at war with Germany. Many Australians left their farms, jobs, homes, families, and pregnant fiancés to fight for King and Empire. Her fiancé was in the 2nd 10th Battalion and went to Libya to defend Tobruk against Rommel's Africa Corps. Erica Walter wrote to tell him about her approaching motherhood, but postal services in the siege of Tobruk were almost non-existent. Erica was left to face her situation with only the support of her close friend Pearl, her sister Margaret, and her father, Eric Walter. I say only because motherhood is really a partnership. It is one half of parenthood, and I've seen so many damaged lives in my school and chaplaincy work where the lack of one parent or other almost always has serious consequences. Motherhood arrives according to its own timetable. I was born on the 5th of June 1941, because there was no way I was going to wait for something as minor as World War II to get out of the way. Erica had not heard from her fiancé, and her mother, my grandmother, insisted that Lamoureux should be spared the embarrassment of an unwed mother and a fatherless child, even if the father was risking his life to keep North Africa in the British Empire. I think there was also a great deal of concern for Erica's future. Just how would she have coped in the world of 1941 with none of the welfare and support services we take for granted today? So the adoption papers were signed at last, and little Richard Walter was sent off to the Kate Cox Children's Home. Just 3 days after this, a stack of letters arrived. On no account, give up our baby. Erica immediately tried to rescind the adoption, and I've since discovered that it was legally possible to do so. But the welfare department said, no, you have signed the papers and it's too late. While Erica and her fiancé both survived the war, their relationship did not. My father was wounded and after a long convalescence returned to marry and settle back into farming at Pinneroo. Erica married Stuart Telford in 1944 and settled in Mount Gambier to raise her family, my two half-brothers and two half-sisters. Four mothers, four vastly different experiences of motherhood. Laurel sought consolation in adoption to deal with her loss. Edna, out of her own tragic loss, sought honesty and openness. Deg breached the code of silence accidentally for her integrity. On Mother's Day, pay attention to your mother. Be kind to her. Pamper her. Show you appreciate what she has done for you. Think of mothers who are no longer with us. Perhaps yours and my four mothers.
You're landing on your feet again. You're spinning round. You're spinning round. Come to the edge of this. Pick up the pieces where you lost it. Don't fall into something you can't get out of. Can't get out of. Don't fall into something you.
Woo! Woo! It was the first time I've ridden a bike in about 15 years. Must have been a bit of a sight to see a rather large woman perched on top of a pearly pink Schwinn debutante cruiser, the Harley Davidson of push bikes. I was grinning my face off the whole way home from work. It was peak hour and I was pretty worried about the traffic. At one intersection, I got off and used the pedestrian crossing. I'm not quite sure where to go when a car is turning left. Do I go in the middle of the cars?
Eek!
I'm putting your arm out as an indication of turning. I felt a bit foolish, but I did it anyway. I loved it so much. Later that night, we screwed on the lights and I rode over to Woolies in the dark, even though I didn't really need anything. I even loved the fact that my bum muscles were sore the next day. And now this morning, I'm determined to ride to work for the first time. And it's been raining quite consistently for the past hour. I've got a clear poncho I bought from Spotlight for 98 cents, but the bike hasn't got mud guards, which is a bit stupid, really. So do I risk it and ride? Hell yeah.
Yippee!
Every morning is a new beginning. It is a chance to start anew, washed clean by sleep and rest, and inspired by the empty hours of the night. Transported by the morning light, be it a gold streak or a shy shade on the horizon. Or it may be that sleep did not come and morning starts heavy with tiredness and worry. All the same, every morning is the chance to do whatever we've been doing a little better, a little bit different. It doesn't take much to start anew. It simply takes the will and deep desire to do so, to give oneself the chance of not running in the exact same tracks, but on the contrary, to move in the same direction in a slightly different way. It takes humility and determination. It takes the courage to try and fail, if it must fail. It takes trust in oneself and in life too, knowing that what you know guides you but must not rule you. It takes life itself, ever moving, changing, transforming. We, the rider of life, can swim in the current of the morning ocean, and then with all the potential changes, make one small, minute adjustment and offer ourselves the chance of a new beginning.
New Beginnings was facilitated and produced by Mike Williams with members of the ABC Pool community. The sound engineer was Phil McKellar. Thanks to Jonathan Hutchinson and Sheila Pham from Pool. The stories you heard were the work of Catherine, Ron Ibsen, Rain Collins, Ross Lamb, Leanne Williams, Susan Durgham, Samantha Crow, Murray Robertson and Tali Teakle. And almost all the music you heard also came from contributions to ABC Pool. If you'd like to see which songs and see how the stories evolved into the final product, head to our website. Just go to the RN homepage and look for 360 documentaries in our program list at abc.net.au/RN. Hopefully, listening to these stories has inspired you to share your story. Don't be shy. ABC Pool's always interested in your contributions, whether you're an amateur just mucking around or a digital media extraordinaire looking for a break. In fact, 360 Documentaries and Pool have just opened up another project. This time, the theme is My Tribe, Journeys. We want you to tell us about your adventures, big or small. There's loads of places your story could end up. It could be broadcast on the night air, on FBI Radio's All the Best program, at an In the Dark event, or right here on 360 Documentaries. For more info, just go to the ABC Pool website. To finish up today, a catchy little tune submitted to Pool by Mark Brennan about his new beginning, moving from Australia to Sweden to marry his deported fiancé. This is Mart with Sydney band The Emmas and a raw recording of his song So I've Got a Plan. I'm Kirsty Melville. Studio production today was by David LeMay. See you next week.
So if you can, I've got a plan that surely would suffice.